Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we have James Hawes talking about the shortest history of Germany.
I will unfold my pointer like the man in Raiders of the Lost Ark, rather, isn't it? I forgot about that. I didn't think of that till just now. We're going to go quite quickly through it all because there's a lot to cover. There are 2,000 years to cover. The point of it all is, of course, to address the question, not to put it too finely, of whether we and Europe can and should trust the Germans, there being plenty of evidence to the contrary in the recent... My own mother had to dodge V1s in Cricklewood and things like that. So there's plenty of people all over Europe who have lots of reasons to doubt it. I, however, will be taking the contrary view, taking the longer view, and trying to persuade you otherwise. So let's begin. Here we have now, we'll start, the story of Germany begins rather handily with one of the greatest men in Europe, Julius Caesar himself, because as far as we know, until Caesar, no one had ever used the word. It certainly isn't recorded anywhere else. Caesar, while he was conquering Gaul, rapidly came across the fact there was all these other threatening people who were constantly crossing the Rhine. And he established, to his own satisfaction, that they were all called generically the Germani. Now, why he did so, we don't know. But the name stuck, so it comes from none other than Julius Caesar himself. Now, this is the picture you may remember from your Gallic War, if you remember that. This is the sort of picture given by Caesar's Gallic War, which is of Gaul and Rome sort of overlapping. The Gauls, if you remember, the Gauls have druids, they have sort of elections, their druids use Greek letters even, they worship gods who can be mapped nicely onto the Greco-Roman pantheon, and they have proper fields and such like, so they're ripe for conquest and taxation and Romanization. The Germans, on the other hand, Caesar decides, are constantly called the Germani Transrhaeni, the Germans across the Rhine. And you have to remember that the Roman audience of the Gallic War knew as little of this as the Victorian audience of Livingstone and Stanley. And Caesar got his big theme in right from the start, that across the Rhine, which of course he had in fact tried twice to invade, but failed entirely, across the Rhine lay a rotten lot of people who were entire pay. They had no property, they had no proper gods, they had no civilization, entirely unsuitable for conquest and colonization by Rome. So rather than admit the truth, which is that he'd twice built bridges across the Rhine and tried to conquer the place and failed, Hitler decided to present his failure as a triumph of finding a proper boundary for the Roman Empire. And that was it, the Rhine, according to Caesar. So Caesar left his readers with the impression that they should, the Romans should watch the Rhine and give the Germans hell every time they tried to cross it. Now, the Romans didn't stick with this for very long, however, because by 9 BC, Drusus, the great Roman general, had set off from bases along the Rhine and had swept all of what we know as West Germany undefeatedly for 3 years until he reached the River Elbe, where, according to this 19th century German artist's rendition, and according to the legends recorded by Suetonius and people, he had a vision of a gigantic German woman saying, "Go no further, foolish one, for your days are numbered." Probably a reference to the Alexander legend and so forth. At any rate, Drusus decided to turn back at the River Elbe, a fateful decision, because the River Elbe was to become, in fact, the border of Western Europe for the next, really, 2,000 years almost. So this, we all know about the disaster of the Teutoburger Forest, the three German legions wiped out, give me back my legions virus and all that business. And people generally believe, as do most Germans, bizarrely, that this was more or less the end of Roman involvement in Germany. It's not at all. This is a map of around 150 AD. This is called the Limes Germanicus. It's Europe's equivalent of the Great Wall of China, 550 miles long, 1,000 almost watchtowers and forts, many of which can still be seen by the naked eye. And inexplicably, it's only really within the last 10 years, quite literally, that this place has got UNESCO status, and people have really begun to realize it was there. Because if you actually look at a map of modern Germany, you will find that within that line lie Cologne, Mainz, Frankfurt, Stuttgart, Augsburg, Munich, you know, all the richest cities and most of the richest areas of modern Germany, with the exception of Hamburg and Berlin, to which we will come later. Hamburg was at this stage non-existent, nor was Berlin. So all the great cities of southwestern Germany and the richest areas to this day, the Catholic areas to this day, lie within the Roman militarized Hadrian's Wall style frontier of around 150 AD. And for some obscure reason, well, it's not really obscure, it's called the Prussians, Prussian historiography. That's gone lost, been wiped out from history. Because, of course, as we'll see later, the Prussians who ran the place from 1871 had a very great vested interest in proposing that the only real Germany was one untouched by Romans, they having been never touched by Romans themselves. So it's an extraordinary erasure has happened in German history. Now, we're very familiar with the notion of the fall of Rome in the Dark Ages, but as this map shows, the vital thing is that really, to the people living around the Rhineland, present-day German-French border, it really wasn't like that. The Western Roman Empire we regard as collapsing in 476, but by 500, the Franks, who were based around here, around Aachen, had already converted to Christianity, the Roman brand, not the Arian brand, and were writing their laws down in Latin, so there was and taking over what had been the Roman Empire. So that for the people who actually lived there, there was virtually no hiatus between being run by a very highly Germanified Roman army of the late Roman Empire, which was Christian and Latin run, and being run by the Franks, who within a decade or two were also Christians and writing their laws down in Latin. And so it stayed, because we have on the left Roman Gaul and Germania at around 150 AD. 600 years later, this is the kingdom of the Franks at the accession of Charlemagne. Now, they're practically identical, as you can see. So that for the people in this, I suppose we call the EU heartland, there really was never a Dark Ages. That part of Germany, this vital western southern part of Germany, was never split off from the continuum of Western European culture, which was, of course, entirely restored in 800 AD by this man, Charlemagne, who pronounced himself, he said, it's the Renovatio Romani Imperius, the Roman Empire is restored through me. And it was seen all through Europe as a renaissance, a restoration of Rome. He ruled his multicultural empire through Latin, though he was a German himself. In fact, in 800 AD, there was only one known, mapped, and civilized country in the world where the laws and the ruling class spoke German, and that was England. We were the most German country in the entire world in 800 AD, because all the other Germans were ruled by Charlemagne through Latin, whereas the English kings and the English church always used the language of the people, which was called Theodiske, which came to mean Teutonic, bizarrely. So the first recorded mention of the word German, that would become German, Teuton, and the most German, culturally most German place on earth was England in 800 AD, strangely enough. So here we have the Carolingian Empire by the time Charlemagne dies in 812. What's happened is he's taken over the Bavarians, by treaty really. He's conquered, after a great deal of trouble, the Saxons, taking his empire to the river Elbe up here. And here we can start to see the outlines of modern Europe starting to appear here. Here's obviously, this is going to become Czechoslovakia here. But he goes no further, and this is the vital point about this, is that although Charlemagne rules an area which is almost exactly the same as the area of the initial six members of the EEC, he does not rule anything east of the River Elbe. So, and it stays that way. This is around the time Otto the Great, 940 AD. I put 960 there, but it's wrong. It's 940 AD. You may notice that this area is extraordinarily like what we come to know as East Germany. These are the marches of Otto the Great's empire around 940 AD. Remember, at this time, we're halfway through German history. We're around the time of Athelstan, and no Germans at all live in that area. It's all Slavs, right? Very important, and we'll see later on why. The Germans in 940, first the Germans try in 945, Otto tries to conquer what's now East Germany. But 20 years later, in 983, the Germans are all thrown out again. And so it stays until 1147. So we're now after Henry I in British times, and there's still no Germans east of the River Elbe. It's only in 1147, as a kind of the northern branch of the Second Crusade, that the Germans actually, under the instigation of what's his name, St. Bernard, go on this holy war, the Great Drang nach Osten, as they call it, to actually conquer this place. And it takes a long time. It's interestingly enough, from our point of view, it's almost exactly coeval with the Anglo-Norman attempt to conquer Ireland. So here we have, it's only in the, in by the year about 1200, It takes 60 years for the Germans to get to present-day Dresden and Germany, longer to get beyond that, and it's only in 1226 and thereafter that the Teutonic Knights go and conquer what will become East Prussia. Note the Polish corridor, not an invention of the Versailles Treaty. It was a fact of European history for hundreds of years, because the Teutonic Knights went into what was then called, the Prussians were a bunch of pagan balts, actually, but the Teutonic Knights piled in there the invitation of the King of Poland to try and conquer them, and they made their own entirely separate state, which was never connected to the rest of Germany at all. And this mad colony of warlike Teutons, of whom my wife is a descendant, and warlike she is sometimes, I can tell you. I'll tell you more a little. I have no chance at all, you know. How can an Englishman fight against the bloody Prussian? It was never complete. Like the Anglo-Norman conquest of Ireland, it was never complete. This is an important thing. And we all know, you know, a complete conquest works quite well, or Normans found it so at any rate. But an incomplete conquest always leaves trouble behind it. Now, and these signs, I photographed these a couple of years ago. It's only 20 miles north of Dresden. They still live to this day. And this is well within, of course, present-day Germany, never mind the bits they've lost. There are still a bunch of people speaking the language they spoke in 1147 AD, called the Zorbs, which is basically a sort of mixture of Polish and Czech. And they've always been there, and they still regard themselves as separate. They were never wiped out or totally conquered. And, of course, this has a big effect. And I have lots of Anglo-Irish friends, and they would admit in their cups, they would say things like, ah, Jim's holding the gate lodge against the Fenians tonight, that kind of thing. When you have a half-successful conquest, the people who have done the conquest, the conquering, always feel that one day that lot over there might rise up again and cut your throat. So that, you know, if the big house falls, so do the little farmers and so forth. So you have a particular relationship grows up between the gentry and the very militarized gentry in their big houses. Of course, the Anglo-Irish gentry were the same, disproportionately represented as splendid officers in the British army because they were all bred to arms. This was the Prussians. In what was essentially a conquered territory, the Germans of the East developed very differently, because they realized that at any given moment, the moment they dropped their guard, the Poles, the Sorbs, the Wends, whatever you want to call them, might well jump up and then you have to do them in one night. So they stayed very, very loyal to their own highly militarized ruling class, who, unlike most of Germany, adopted primogeniture, as did the British, but they didn't adopt primogeniture titles. They all got the fon. So if you look at any German noble family, they're not really like English aristocrats. They're more they're sort of more like a gentry caste, but they've all got the title. So Germany, in particular Prussia, became very full of people who had very proud titles and absolutely no money at all. And all they had was their title, and they were going to bloody well defend that to the death. And they would Dickens's own magazine has articles about this in the 1870s, 1880s. They would literally not stick you dead in the street if you didn't get out of the way for them. Even if a woman didn't, they'd kill her partner. In the 1880s in Berlin, because all they had was this mad militaristic pride, which meant the only jobs they could get were in the army or the state, the only jobs they would do. Anyway, so it created this very particular society called, we know as Prussia. Now, we have to rush forward a bit here. Now, this is Germany in the kind of high Middle Ages. You've probably heard of the seven great electors. The German throne was elective. It was elective, not by inheritance. There were the electors of Cologne, Mainz, and Trier, who were all archbishops, Catholic archbishops. Then there were the four lay electors, Palatinate, the King of Prague, the Wittelsbachs in Saxony, and the Duke of Brandenburg, all of whom were laymen. Now, what you notice about this, of course, is that apart from the Palatinate chap here, all these three families who will become the greatest, most powerful families in later German history, the Habsburgs, the Wettins, and the Hohenzollerns, their power base is all on or even beyond the borders of what would have been considered Germany right up until 1147. They are fundamentally Eastern-facing powers, and they're bringing in structures of power, ways of thinking, which are far more like Russian ones, frankly, than the normal Western European ones. Here's an interesting one. Now, this is after the Reformation. God damn it! After the curse of the Reformation had descended upon Germany. This is a map with an outline for reasons that will become obvious later on of modern Germany, or rather Germany around 18 years before the First World War, after the First World War, showing the different confessions that resulted from the Reformation. As you can see, if one were to draw a line of the Roman limes along there, it quite accurately tracks in like that. There are very few Protestants south of it. This area here, we'll leave that map for now. We'll come back to it in a minute. Perhaps you can guess why. Well, it'll surprise you, perhaps, or perhaps it won't, I don't know. Anyway, so Germany becomes confessionally split. And it's confessionally split. In Germany, confession is nothing to do with theology any more than it is in Northern Ireland. It doesn't mean you believe. You don't become a Catholic or Protestant because you believe in transubstantiation or anything like transubstantiation or not. You are a Catholic or Protestant because of where you are born. It's important to remember that Germany is a very mixed culture confessionally, but the mix is entirely geographically determined. If you come from there, you're a Catholic, you're a Protestant, and if you come from there, you're a Catholic, and always have been, right back to 1500 odd. It's simply a badge of which cultural Germany you come from. Now, the problem Germany had through the long 18th century, which is a phrase I'm sure you're familiar with, it was, of course, the hegemony of France. If the population of Europe were the same proportionately now as during the long 18th century, there'd be about 250 million French. So France is this enormous great power in the 18th century, and this means that all of the small German statelets in the West are absolutely in its shadow, and they do try to bound together in a thing called the First Rhine League of 1674, I believe. But it's hopeless, because anything they do right up to Napoleon's day really means that they become hopeless satellites of France and mere tools of French diplomacy. Whereas the Habsburgs and the Hohenzollerns, with the Wettins squished in between them, have this big buffer between them. So they're able to develop separately from the great French radiation of the long 18th century. And what they both do is expand eastwards. 1690, the Habsburgs, the Battle of Zenta, the Habsburgs gain the whole of what's now Hungary. They organize the relief of Vienna. So they're expanding eastwards. The Prussians unite. They close the Polish corridor and unite the duchies of Prussia and Brandenburg. Russia's right on their border here. And the Wettins, in fact, become kings of Poland. So all these three German dynasties start looking eastwards to get more power for themselves in order to kind of escape from this French westernized radiation coming at them. And of course, Prussia becomes this sort of bizarre superpower during the Seven Years' War when, thanks largely to our help, we subsidized it to an extraordinary extent. By far the biggest British subsidies ever given to anyone were given to the Prussians to keep them in the Seven Years' War. They made their name as this extraordinary militarized state, famously Voltaire saying, other states have armies, in Prussia the army has a state. And this is one of my wife's ancestors, who was Frederick the Great's catamite, being mourned by Frederick the Great after the Battle of Zorndorf. Anyway, so you had this extraordinary caste of highly militarized Junkers, as we know the great word, whose deal with the Prussian state was this: we will be totally loyal to you to the death. We will provide you with countless young subalterns who will willingly die and drive their men into cannon fire if you treat us like special people. It was a deal. It wasn't just absolute monarchy. The Prussian state and the Junkers did this deal whereby they would be regarded as an untouchable elite who had a complete monopoly of top jobs in the civil service and the army, in return for which they would ensure absolute loyalty to the House of Hohenzollern. It was a two-way thing. Now, the problem for the poor West Germans, of course, was that by 1800, French Revolution started, and France is making its last great bid to rule Europe. In the east, you have Prussia and the Habsburg Empire, both of these enormous great territories in the east, both bordering directly onto Russia. And in the middle, you have this hopeless mess of little Western states who just cannot get together. They try quite hard. They make the Second Rhine League. They actually, in 1803, they all get together and they welcome Napoleon just before he crowned himself. And they say, thank you for coming over and freeing us from the barbarians, by which they meant the Prussians. But again, they're hamstrung by this fact that whatever they do, they'll be simply tools of France. And here, now that looks like West Germany. It's not actually. It's the Confederation of the Rhine, a misnomer, obviously. This is the Confederation of the Rhine in 1812 at its height. And as you can see, it comprises the whole of modern-day West Germany. And Prussia has been kicked right out now. Prussia whacked at Jena-Auerstadt. They held on for another year thinking the Russians might rescue them. When the Prussians were whacked at Friedland, the Treaty of Tilsit threw the Prussians right out back across the Elbe. You think it should have been the end of them. The only reason Prussia even survived as a kingdom, because Napoleon considered simply abolishing it, was that the Tsar said, well, no, they're an old royal family. And Napoleon wanted an alliance. He actually wanted to marry his daughter to the Tsar, to marry into the royal family and get
get respectability being a complete parvenu. So he allowed the Kingdom of Prussia to exist solely as a satrap of Russia. And we forget this. If you look at the British press, right up to about 1863, 1864, the German-Danish War, the British press, things like Punch, just portray Prussia as Russia's jackal. It was simply a client state of Russia. From now on, the myth of it standing up against Napoleon was entirely nonsense. The Prussians didn't rebel against Napoleon until the Russians were actually across the border, and they had no chance. So they had to choose one way or the other. They managed to spin it as a heroic resistance because the Habsburgs were so utterly incompetent. They chose the wrong thing. And then something very strange happened, and it was thanks to us. Now we, being all powerful in 1815, decided that what we wanted to do was we wanted to split Prussia away from its dependence on Russia and create a barrier against French expansion. So we, solely us, we decided to give this to Prussia. Britain presented the Russians with this. It became known as Rhenish Prussia. And we presented it to Russia without consulting anybody. The Prussians didn't actually want it because they're all Catholics. What the Prussians wanted was all of Saxony, but the Austrians were prepared to fight that. And extraordinary enough, in between Napoleon's first defeat and the Battle of Waterloo, England, Austria, and France almost went to war with Russia and Prussia about Saxony. So once Napoleon was finally done in, the British had this brilliant scheme. We would give this enormous, wealthy, advanced trading part of Europe, probably the most advanced capitalist part of Europe apart from Britain itself, to the Prussians. Thus, overnight, turning them from this bunch of backward Junkers into a bunch of backward Junkers who could now afford to re-equip their armies with needle guns and such like, and have enormous cannon foundries here in Essen, where Krupp had his factories. It's entirely due to this utter British miscalculation that Prussia had the power to take over the whole of Germany. Now, it did. Cut a long story short, there was no German reunification. Germany conquered Prussia. The Germans don't even seem to remember this themselves. We probably remember the Battle of Königgrätz in 1866, where, re-equipped with their needle guns, the Prussians mowed down the Austrians completely, as they would have done any army in Europe, because every other army in Europe, like the Austrians, only had muzzle loaders at that stage. The Austrians had been offered needle guns. They couldn't afford them. The Prussians could, because they were so rich, thanks to us. They created the Prussian Empire. That's all it was. The rest of Germany kept on fighting 3 weeks after Königgrätz. It's not often remembered by Germans themselves. I was in Berlin saying, and no one believed me until I showed them the evidence. You know, the Prussians surrounded Russia 3 weeks, surrounded Frankfurt, the ancient capital of Germany, 3 weeks after the Battle of Königgrätz and said, either you pay us 24 million gold bars by tonight, or we're going to bombard your city to the ground and then unleash our Prussian farm boys on you. And that's what is extraordinary. So it's a simple conquest. The vital thing about German history is that everything that happens in Germany from 1870 onwards is nothing to do with Germany. It's a Prussian empire. And it was the Prussians ran everything, and they managed to successfully rewrite the whole of German history, consciously imitating Macaulay's version of English history, in fact, to suggest that the whole of history, German history, was now rightfully, had teleologically come to bear in the creation of Prussia. It remained utterly split along the line, the old lines. Remember, here we are. This is the old sort of Catholic bit of Germany. The right-wing monarchist tough parties of Germany in the German Empire always got their votes from Prussia. There's a geographical split. This is 1874. Now, it goes on and on, right up to those eastern areas are where people like Bismarck can get their bankers' votes from every year. We have to get used, essentially, to seeing German politics like American politics with blue and red states, because the politics are unchanging over the last 100 years. Now, this is it's not a fantasy of mine. This is Gust Adenauer, the future founder of West Germany, saying right after the First World War, Prussia has ruled Germany and lorded over the peoples of Western Germany, whose whole way of thinking is essentially sympathetic to the peoples of the Entente. If Prussia were to be divided up, and so forth. Adenauer actually appealed to the French and the British after World War I to break Germany up and take Prussia out of the equation. Unfortunately, we, not understanding our German history, didn't. Because Britain was still enthralled to this thing, which is still, I think, it's still surprisingly enough around a bit these days. People naturally seem to think Protestant good, Catholic bad. The Catholics are all a bunch of right-wing fascists, and the Protestants are liberals. It's completely the opposite in Germany, as I shall now show. So this is 1924. This goes to show why we have to think of red and blue states like America. Now, the Reichstag elections of 1924, this party, the DNVP, the Deutsche Nationale Volkspartei, is the second biggest party in the Reichstag. All of their votes come from what used to be East Elbian Prussia, the Protestant Lutheran areas, every single one of them. So Germany is split entirely along these confessional lines with, frankly, the baddies coming from the east. And here they are, the baddies. Splendid chaps. This is the Deutsche Nationale Volkspartei, who were sort of anti-Semites and right-wing militarists and went around shooting chancellors and people like that. And then we come to the Nazis. Well, you can't talk about the genesis of Nazism already, but let me just show you what Nazism was in a picture. Here we have the Bauhaus, famous Bauhaus building, built by sort of vaguely lefty progressive architects who thought it would be a good thing for everyone to be made to live in factories, and that would be good, and we'd all be happier that way. Here we have the Reichstag Ministry of 1936. Sorry, the Air Ministry of 1936. Identical lines, identical materials. What the Nazis did was give it a little facade of cod classical architectural details to make it look as though they were conservatives. They were not. The Nazis were not conservatives. The Nazis had actually very little to do with European fascism at all. The Nazis were a radical social movement whose roots were in, you know, were in sort of class warfare. They basically have far more in common with the Bolsheviks than they do with anyone else in Europe. So this is the trick Hitler managed to play was to convince people he was really a conservative when actually he was a sort of racist Darwinian social radical, mad utopian in a sort of black utopia. Now, who actually voted Nazi though? Well, as you've probably guessed by now, here's the Nazi vote in 1930. The more black, the more Nazi. And as you can see, if we lay that old line of the lemurs across it, the Nazis are not getting very many votes at all. This is their breakthrough year. They suddenly leap from being nowhere to being the second biggest party. And it's all driven by votes from the Lutheran northeast of the country. Absolutely all of it. That's only that make the suddenly leaps them from being no one to being a major party and thus getting all the funding and all the media coverage and so forth. They essentially took over the votes of the DNVP. That's all that happened. And it continues on. Here we have a map. On the left, we have the Nazi vote of 1932. On the right, a map of the Catholic and Protestant divide in Germany in 1932. As you will see, they are practically mirror images. It's quite simple. You can draw an XY graph. The more Catholic the area, the less likely to vote Nazi. It's as simple as that. And it's not just me saying so. I mean, this is the most distinguished German electoral, whatever you call them, cephologist. And after pages and pages of graphs and tables and mathematical whatever they do, cephologists, he comes to this conclusion. The greatest factor is almost always the confessional makeup of the constituency measured by the proportion of Catholic voters. It is astonishingly robust. He seems surprised himself to discover this. He assumed at the beginning of his essay, like most people still do, because they're all Marxists these days, fools that we are, he assumed it was all to do with class and income and jobs and gender and things. It's not. It's with culture. The same as Trump and Brexit and things, to do with culture. It's not to do with money and class, it's to do with culture. And he realized that really, if you're a Catholic, you didn't vote Nazi. End of story, essentially. And here, just to prove the point, here is our confessional divide, 1550. Look how exactly you can map things like Hesse, little blobs. The pattern here of these, the white area is the Nazi-ish vote. Here's that area coming down like this. Look at this area here, modern-day Baden-Württemberg. It's Nazi then. It was Protestant then. This is 500 years before. It does not change. So here, this is the vital election. At this stage, remember, Hitler's not in power now. It's more like a referendum, because the choice in 1933 is, do you want the Hitler coalition to stay in power or not? So a vote for either Hitler or the Prussian DNVP says yes. A vote for everyone else says no. Here are the votes. As you can see, still, even now, when the Nazis have Hitler is now chancellor, though not only having been got in through the back door by the Prussian aristocrats, there are huge areas of the Catholic West which still are only voting 30-odd% of it for the Nazis, even though they have complete control of the media and have, you know, stormtroopers in the police and so forth by now. Look at the East. People voting 55-56%. It's worse than that, because in these areas there are a further 10% of people voting for the leftovers of the DNVP. My grandfather-in-law, for example, who said, we're not Nazis, we'll vote for the Hitler coalition. Without them, they could not have taken power. Even in 1933, with all the forces of the state at his command, Hitler could not have got anywhere near a majority of his so-called coalition had it not been for these thumping great votes in what we have to call the kind of, you know, south of the Mason-Dixon line states. So there we go again. To cut short, there we have Otto's empire, 960 AD, and there's East Germany. Do I have to make a point? Yeah. East Germany is not different because it was run by the Russians. That's the point I make to Germans all the time. East Germany is different because it always was different. It's been different for 800 years. And it still is. There's the AfD vote today. It's entirely limited, except for, of course, if one were to go back, one would see this area was voting for the Nazis. It's a Protestant Lutheran area. Even within Baden-Württemberg, these areas are Protestant islands within a Catholic country. The exception, of course, is here. And these are the very areas of Bavaria near Passau, which Merkel's folly turned into this kind of grand trunk road for immigrants 2 years ago. And the people around there, perhaps understandably, not very keen on it. And there we are. That's it. Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.